but I've read it suggested that some persons have such a high level of pesticides in their fat that going on a diet could be hazardous to them because they would mobilize the pesticide from their fat. And I think that would be especially true, for example, of pesticide applicators who may have a great deal of it. So there's a long-term storage of these pesticides in fat, and again, we're talking about thousands of compounds and thousands of different ways of using them, and whether the person, there's no way with that many variables to say if this is a safe way to do it. That's as simple as that. Now, I believe there's no overwhelming reason to ever apply any chemical pesticides or herbicides in Alaska. I have a farm myself. I do a lousy job farming. But I am aware that tillage practices and so forth were very successful in bearing crops before, and rotation of crops were very successful before pesticides and herbicides became available. I believe that all chemical herbicides and pesticides are bad news. As far as we can tell, we frequently don't know. Some of them may be just fine, but I don't think the studies are there to show that. Biologically, however, I think that there's a great deal of possibility for killing particular pests and also possibly for foliage work. Although, you know, what you really need is something that'll grind up foliage into small fertilizer pellets, and certainly the moose does that as well as anyone. But the question is, if you see a moose, are you then going to feel like you're getting a dose of something you don't want to get when you shoot them? That's a significant question. Now, I do not think any legislation against chemical pesticides should, however, make it impossible to use biological deterrents. There are various biological things as a bacteria, which I can't pronounce the name of, thuringiensis or something like that, that's very good for eliminating certain pests, and it doesn't bother anyone else. Biologically, Mother Nature has managed to attack things much more specifically than the chemical industry seems able to do, and also relatively successfully. I would like to see any legislation avoid making biological-type assaults on either insects or foliage illegal. Now, the sprayers around here, if they were to eliminate spraying and other applications of chemicals, would probably have to find other work. I'm in the process of finding other work myself. I'm working part-time now, but I'm going into something different probably, and I see no reason why they can't do it. There are lots of want ads, and I recommend them to them. I'll tell you this, that the pesticide guys that I've talked to, if they're being honest, are significantly worried about their own health. As I said, this friend of mine has been chronically ill for years, was one of them, in his own farm, and it's a problem. At least, if a person's going to apply pesticides, it would seem legitimate. Something as dangerous as a pesticide, which is more hazardous, perhaps, than some of the medicines that are, although we are told that it's as safe as aspirin, aspirin has some definite risks also. And it would seem appropriate to get a prescription before you apply anything of that sort, a prescription from someone who's knowledgeable on its use and on its hazards, rather than somebody coming around telling you, I'm going to spray this place. They might or might not tell you what the chemical was. That might or might not be the chemical in the tank, and it might or might not be at the concentration that's safe. I was sprayed with a couple of chemicals that allegedly weren't exactly cute, and one of the side effects is chest pain, and I can't tell you how many milligrams per kilogram it was, but it hurt in my chest, and it nearly killed me. And I think that's a legitimate complaint on my behalf, and it was legitimately applied pesticide. I think that we're all in this long row of objects known as birds and bees and flowers. There's honey that's being picked up, and the question is the honey we're getting full of this stuff, is it concentrated again? I admit it's diluted in the environment, but would some of the stuff be again concentrated? There are lots of little insects and animals that concentrate various things, and if they're in the food chain, for example, various metallic and other substances, mercury and so forth, frequently get into certain organisms, and then those are part of the food chain of someone else. It's just too complicated for people to be messing around with it at this stage of knowledge. Now, the Alaska highway system had this stuff made illegal, the herbicide sprays beside the road, and I think the Alaska highway is holding up fine. The bicycle paths, that was a relatively nonsensical reference because nobody knows what it takes to keep a bicycle path in good shape, and the fact is they're built to much lower specifications than highways. They have a thinner surface, a thinner undersurface, and poorer drainage. And this is still an experiment, the bicycle path business. I don't think that that is a legitimate quote, and I think that destroying the vegetation next to the bicycle path mechanically is fine summer work for a lot of kids that wouldn't have it otherwise. I'd like to suggest that anybody that sprays anything be required to add a coloring agent and a flavoring agent to that spray that lasts as long as any environmental persistence in the environment of that substance. Because if your house gets sprayed or your vegetable garden gets sprayed and it all turns purple, at least you know that you've been hit. And when you taste it, if it tastes like something real lousy, the way the gas companies are required to put something in their gas, which is significantly dangerous. Everyone who's ever smoked in the presence of gasoline or gas vapor would certainly tell you that. I think that the smell is important, and I think the taste is important. I think the color is important. And if your house turns purple after he sprays the tree line between your two houses, which obviously if he's going to spray up, it's going to keep going in that general direction. If you know anything about ballistics, depending on the wind, it might go the other way. Depending on the particle size, it could evaporate and go into the upper atmosphere, because after all, sea salt is very common in the upper atmosphere from the little sprays in the ocean. I believe that there needs to be marking on our pesticide sprays. I think that if we eliminated spraying entirely anywhere in the state, then it'd be easy to get rid of the fly-by-nights, because the fly-by-nights got this big truck and they're running around. The locals, the respectable and the persistently present pesticide sprayers, seem to feel that that would be a help to their business, that would overcome the loss of the spraying. But if all of us citizens who saw somebody spraying knew that it was illegal, we could certainly report it in a hurry. I think that the Alaska Railroad and the professor and others are relying on the literature. I think the literature is unreliable. I think the Alaska Railroad roadbed is clearly in terrible shape, and in fact, the evidence that's been presented to various committees suggests that it's going to have to take anywhere up to $80 million to correct this problem. So hardly can anyone say herbicides have upgraded things. In fact, it would be really nice in our pollution situation that we have here if we could take the train to Palmer and back and have a regular run, but they can't because they can't go at any speed because they'll hop off the so-called well-maintained herbicide tracks. There are people here that need guidelines. The Alaska Railroad is a outfit that's run by a very fine manager, or was, I don't know what the current situation is, Mr. Jones. He is, however, working within financial and other restrictions. I think that if we give him guidelines, there will be no herbicide spraying, there will be no pesticide spraying. If we give those guidelines around the state, I'm quite sure we can work our way around it. We have a very high unemployment level. I see no excuse for using chemicals that have long-lasting effect on us and the environment, and in exchange for not passing a few dollars around to people that are willing to work on the weeds. The municipality is a real good example here. They plant a bunch of trees in sidewalks that don't come from around here, and they notice that they're wilting, and then their job's in danger. Now, if the job of the person that put those trees is in danger, what's he going to do? He goes around and starts spraying any bug that would eat a sick tree, and in fact blames the bug for the problem. But the fact is that the next thing you see is the little kids are playing in the park under this tree or whatever, and the little kids are exposed to a high level of this repeatedly, and the reason for that is that the particular people in the chain of command are trying to cover their own problem. And in other words, they've got a tree. If that tree dies, somebody's going to ask them, why did that tree die and why did you spend the money on it to start with? So they're trying to cover those things. They're trying to cover their job. But that's not exactly as important to us that are living here chronically. A few dead trees, while they learn that only some trees grow in Alaska and some don't, is fine as far as I'm concerned, rather than having somebody's kid crawling around on the pavement or whatever after they've been spraying. So I'd like to say that if you gentlemen would be so kind as to establish limits, I'm sure that this, that both agriculture, railroading, highways, and everything else will work just fine in the state, and that those limits will be held to, and it's easier to establish there will be no pesticides or there will be no herbicides, and then see what you can do from that level, than it is to say, with 177 or whatever chemicals that are available, that you can use 62 of them, but only at half strength. I think that way we'll never solve the problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you. We'll take about a 3 minute recess. Public hearing on herbicides and pesticides. And I'd like those in the Anchorage LIO room to retake their seats. I'd also like to acknowledge that since 2:45 this afternoon in Juneau, Senator Fahrenkamp, who is the designee to chair the Senate Health Committee in 1985 and 1986, has been represented at the conference by Sandra Schubert, Senator Staff, who Senator Fahrenkamp provided for that presentation. I'll call upon David Woodworth of the Alaska Health Project.
Good afternoon. Now, how do I do this one? Alaska. That's what I want to do. Is that right? Okay. Good afternoon. I appreciate the committee holding this hearing, I think it's an appropriate issue to begin talking about and continue to talk about in the future. Once again, my name is David Wigglesworth with the Alaska Health Project, and a lot of what I have to say has been said previous, so I'll just kind of reiterate a few things and then go on to other issues that I will bring up in this testimony. One study referred to was in discussing how there's very little toxicity evidence, toxicity data available on pesticides, was a National Research Council study, which was funded by the National Toxicological Program. And I just want to quote one little piece of data that they concluded in their study, which is, so little toxicity testing and exposure information is available on tens of thousands of important commercial chemicals that assessing their potential hazard to human health is not now possible. Also, in discussing the issue of LC50 and LD50, as has been expressed by Dr. Von Hippel, that they are good as far as they go, as far as testing how many animals will die, 50% of the population will die in 96 hours. But what they don't go into is they don't give you any kind of reflection on the teratogenicity or the birth defects that possibly the chemical could cause on people being exposed to it or animals. They don't go into the carcinogenicity. They don't bring up the other health implications. I see, as he used the analogy of the car accident, where maybe people don't die, but they do get injured. So these tests are only as good as far as they go. These issues point to a real clear fact that there's a myth going about that the federal or the system of registering pesticides is adequate. I think the issues brought up today show that it's entirely inadequate. Industry does most of the testing. Government does not have the funds to do the testing. Government, up until recently, has not done any type of critical review of chemicals. EPA now is getting into looking more into the review reviewing industry testing of chemicals, pesticides. There has been falsification of data. And one fact that's not always known is that many pesticides were used now or grandfathered in at the time that the federal program was enacted in the early 70s. To guarantee that a pesticide is safe is next to impossible, and the federal program or the system does not pretend to manage pesticides by their safety, but on a reasonable risk. So if anybody says that a pesticide is safe, that's not too true, because we don't know. There's a lot of unknowns. Yet it's clear that the current federal system is not assessing risk to the level necessary to protect the public, the environment, and the people actually applying the pesticide. And I think a fundamental question that we may want to ask ourselves as a state is, are we willing to follow the present system with its loose guidelines, the unknown risks that are inherent in the system, the unknown liabilities that the state may incur by following present systems? The registration system is not a guarantee, and the state should assess more definitively pesticide use policies in the state. Anchorage is going about trying to develop their own little policy. What's Fairbanks doing? What's Delta Junction doing? What's Juneau doing? Are there other little groups, public groups, about trying to develop their own little policies? Maybe we're going to have a hodgepodge of these little policies all over the state. And what I think it's clear time that we should, as a state, look definitively into developing an overall pesticide policy for the state. One that does not necessarily have to eliminate pesticides, for they do have some purpose in certain cases, as people have been saying. In certain instances, possibly pesticides are the best application. But before we can say that they are, we must develop a program that rationally outlines a clear-cut decision-making process to determine if, in that certain instance, pesticides are the best alternative. We must develop a program that does not assume that pesticides are the answer. There are alternatives. And you can go into mechanical cutting or biological controls and that sort of thing. We must have a policy that encourages the least toxic approach if pesticides are to be used. For instance, just want to bring up the issue of the 2,4-D that people were talking about related to the railroad. The issue of its breakdown properties wasn't necessarily brought up. What does it break down into after 2 weeks or so? I'm not entirely positive how long it takes to break down. It's a week or 2 weeks, something like that. But it breaks down into other types of materials. What are they? A contaminant, dioxin, in 2,4-D or 2,4-5-T. While 2,4-D may be toxic in parts per million, dioxin, which is a common contaminant, and maybe as people are expressing, it's just a very little bit in there, dioxin is toxic in parts per billion. A very little bit of dioxin goes a long way. And we must really address these issues. We must also have a policy that where the public is informed, workers are informed, as well as managers. I think in our experience with the Right to Know program, and the worker Right to Know program in the state of Alaska right now, is that now the safety managers actually working for the businesses aren't really seeing the benefits of such a system. There are numerous little anecdotes where managers have had this information and actually protected workers on the North Slope and have found that chemicals they thought they had were indeed the wrong chemical when they went back and cross-checked it with the material safety data sheet that they had on the supposed chemicals that they were supposed to be using. So information is good to have, and the public and workers and managers should have it. As far as the LC50 and LD50 issue, obviously we, as I think someone from the railroad is suggesting, the toxicity is a question of many factors. It includes LC50, it includes how much does it take to make you sick, as I'm quoting, or what are the long-term effects. When we look at chemicals and pesticides, we're trying to determine how we should use them, and if we should use them, we should look at the whole parameter of issues related to their toxicity, not just using the simple LC50 test. In the final analysis, this is just one example of a whole host of other problem areas in Alaska related to hazardous materials. Currently, right now, the Health Project is doing a study of hazardous materials incidents, if you will, across the state, taking various databases from numerous sources such as DEC, such as Department of Labor, such as the newspaper, the university, other databases. In a year period, we're trying to analyze all the different hazardous materials incidents, which includes spills, exposures, that sort of thing. Using DEC's database alone in Fairbanks just for 1 year, we're just doing a one-year period, we found 160,000 gallons were spilled in Alaska, ranging in the northern region based on northern DEC's information. Now, this can range from just a drop, or it can range from many gallons, thousands of gallons. The issue here is that when we get all this other data compiled, we're going to see many more gallons being spilled in the state than we're previously suspected. What about waste oil? If indeed the federal government and the Resource Conservation Recovery Act follows through with its proposed plan to ban certain uses of waste oil, especially on the roads, how is the state going to address this question? The Alaska Railroad, I know, has many gallons of waste oil. The municipality of Anchorage has many gallons of waste oil. Fairbanks, many gallons of waste oil. How are we going to deal with this? Especially if we can't put it on our roads, which is a common process in this state. The airport, for example. Someone brought up, one of the committee members brought up the example of what's happening in Anchorage is kind of a reflection of what may happen in the rest of the part of the states later on. The classic midnight dumping situation out of International Airport Road, where the various facilities out there were dumping some of their barrels into the fire pit out there. And on more investigation, I realized that there's some 200, say, barrels out there with many different types of solvents, lead, certain benzenes there. These should have been handled in a different way, and for sure the possibility of firefighters actually going in there and responding to, say, practice emergency fire situations without proper protection should have been looked into, I think, a little bit further. What about transportation of hazardous materials? With the abolishment of the Alaska Transportation Commission, we now have, and though I think I hear things are changing as far as DOT taking on the role of regulating transportation in the state, but we really don't have any real management investigation into safe transport in the state. Rarely do we have people checking the trucks to see if their axles are to the right specifications, their brakes work. Even in the case of actually licensing people who drive trucks. Right now, to my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's no real licensing procedure in the state for people driving trucks. That I or any one of us with a license to drive a car or any vehicle in the state could presumably hop into one of the big tractor-trailer trucks and drive it. Bush development, the doll factory out there is going to be making dolls out of polyurethane foams. What may not be obvious to people is that isocyanates are very much part of that process. Isocyanates are found in polyurethane foams in house construction. How are we going to transport those things? Are we going to store? How are we going to store them? What about disposal issues? The state, you know, there's a whole host of issues, and this is one. The herbicide pesticide issue is one of many. And I am encouraged by the citizen groups that have been trying to work locally here with the municipality to try to work out a rational solution where you bring in all parties concerned. And I was encouraged by the pesticide applicators actually suggesting some solutions. Realizing that this is the way the world is going to be working sooner or later. We have to really begin to fund departments like DEC, Department of Labor, with adequate funding to get them going and get them out there to do what their mandate is to do, which is protect the environment and protect workers and public health in Alaska. And we must make this a priority, because if it's not a priority, then it will never get done. And I think that all of us here today are seeing that there's many issues out there and people are being exposed and there are problem areas. It's going to cost more money, say, if the railroad or other people can't do certain things a certain way. But, we just have to make some decisions here, and I think this is a good forum to try to do that and try to make some decisions.
Mr. Livingworth, let me ask you something. You mentioned the piecemeal or potentially inconsistent policies of state agencies. What is your understanding of the highway approach to weed control?
What I do know about that is that my understanding is that back in Governor Hammond's administration, he did issue an executive order stating to the requesting that the Department of Transportation not spray herbicides along the road system. And this raises a fundamental point that at any time, really, the DOT could begin to begin spraying those herbicides along the highway right of way. And I think that they were using 240 at that time when Hammond issued the order.
Some of us had advocated that the railroad be in the Department of Transportation, and I regret that wasn't done, but I suppose one question that will arise is whether there should not be a single policy for all of the state transportation agencies, including the railroad corporation, and if not, at least some justification by an agency that wants to depart from the policy that has been effect.
I guess it raises philosophical questions. But if you're in the business of applying pesticides, you're in the business of producing products which have byproducts that are hazardous or potentially dangerous to human health and the environment, then you should be held accountable for that and provide ample data and information suggesting that the way you're going to manage that is appropriate and safe and will not in any event harm human life or the environment. And in conjunction with that, there should be some sort of financial responsibility attached onto that, that in case there isn't a spill or some sort of victim or some sort of catastrophe. I'll mention the Bhopal incident because that's one that everyone's familiar with right now. But if there is some sort of catastrophe, then the businesses should play a large part in compensating people for that, because they are in the business of dealing with those substances.
It's a little bit difficult for the lay politician to deal with, because we have in testimony today, for example, some testimony that a couple dealing with a pesticide issue were told not to consume food off the garden. And then we had the doctor talking about the possible shortcomings or biases in some of the studies that seem to be exculpatory of herbicides, health hazards. But what I don't, and you talked about the unknown involved, but we don't have a lot of hard information indicating the direct health, health implications. Of the herbicide program in the Sanctuary, or there wasn't a for the judge. No, we haven't put all the testimony yet.
Yeah, it's difficult because a lot of times, as people were expressing, that often the onset of disease, from the time of exposure to the onset of the disease is often a long period of time. And so maybe now, as a result of our massive increase in chemical use and production back in the late 40s and 50s, now we're beginning to see the cancers and that sort of thing. Asbestos is a classic example of that. People thought it was safe, and now we're seeing the effects, long-term effects, 20, 30 years down the road. It's difficult to tell. I I'm not about to advocate any type of human research, that's for sure. What we have to do is look at all the data and come up with a rational decision and a plan and a policy guideline for when pesticides are, say, if we're getting back to the pesticide issue, when pesticides or herbicides are to be used. And there's no real clear-cut decision-making process. It's very arbitrary, and we're basing a lot of our decision-making on the industries and people funded by the industries that stand ready to make a clear profit by the sale of that product. And I think it's important to realize that.
And the agencies doing this don't require permits from DEC or Department of Labor, do they?
I know there are DEC and Department of Labor representatives here, so I'd like to have them answer that.
Do any Senator Kennedy have any? One thing, David, don't we have a lot of data available to you that would come from the lower 48 perhaps, or would our latitude change the problems that we would encounter with the herbicides and the chemicals that we're faced with up here now?
That's a very good question. I know that there have been people here in the state trying to answer that question and been trying to do their own studies, but I do know that one, the Alaska Public Health Association, and as well people in that department, Dr. Middow, for sure, is very interested in the effects of Arctic climates, the soil types, on the metabolic properties of a certain herbicide or a pesticide or a chemical. We don't have a lot of that data available to us, and I know it's of concern to a lot of people in the state.
In other words, what you're saying is we can't accept at face value any of the test results that would come from a lower latitude and apply them to this area here.
I guess it would be difficult to definitively say that you can, you know, use one study and then apply it directly to another area. You know, there have been people who have looked into the way certain herbicides react in other northern climates, Arctic climates, but still, I think there's real need for primary research done in Alaska. And in conjunction with that, there's real need for the state to have the adequate laboratory and testing facilities here in the state. We have grossly inadequate testing facilities. We have to send a lot of our sampling, say if the Department of Labor goes in and samples certain areas, or, well, that's a bad example, but say DEC would test a toxic chemical or something like that, or they barely have to send it out of state to really get a good analysis, although they do have some in-state lab assistance.
Well, basically, now, currently, the major lab that we have right now has to be in the agricultural test site. Is that what you're saying?
That I'm not sure. To my knowledge, that we have very inadequate laboratory facilities here in the state.
In other words, one of the things we would advocate then was an increased number or facilities for testing on the herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, etc. But it seems to me like we've got a golden opportunity now before we get polluted to find out what it's like before and then what's going to happen in the meantime.
It's a good idea. I think there's definitely people here in state. I think we have definitely qualified people here in state with the extension service of the university to do that testing. But I don't know exactly what equipment they do need. But in some instances, from my experience, there have been labs which have needed equipment to do the proper testing. And
are you familiar with that herbicide manual or recommendation that Dr. Mitchell gave us up here a little bit ago? I noticed that Agricultural Science and Technology Report number 77, the thing that, and I might say this, Bill, I hope you don't mind me saying this, the thing that disturbs me about that booklet there is the fact it's dated 1978. It makes me have a great deal of concern that perhaps we're not up to date. That's why one of the reasons I asked the question about what studies and so forth we needed.
I think if, in my occupation, in trying to discuss the occupational health effects with the workers, one of the critical things you have to look at is the date of your research that you're looking into to determine an actual cause or a potential danger to a worker or somebody using a chemical material. The time of the study is critical, and so when in developing a policy toward say pesticide or herbicide use in Alaska, maybe one of the policies should be all the latest information and research should be the information that we use in our decision making.
I had a great deal of concern because we have a fledgling agricultural industry that very well be affected by some of the things that come about on the decisions made on the railroad, for example, and the highway. This is what I have a concern about, a big concern, whether we're doing it right or whether we're not doing it right, and it's going to affect hopefully a major industry in the state. Maybe we can stop before it's too late.
I hope so.
Are there other questions from the Senator?
John, thank you very much.
Is Mary Corn here? I see, all right, I'm sorry. Raymond Jenkins?
I'm glad to be here and have an opportunity to inform the committee on some of the activities that the Department of Labor is participating in. My name is Raymond Jorgensen. I'm the chief industrial hygienist for the State Department of Labor in their labor standards and safety section. And we do occupational safety and health programs. We also are the people that manage the right to know legislation that was passed. And basically, I came here to be invited by Steve Kadish to ask you if there was anything you wanted to know about what the Department of Labor was doing with the railroad inspection program that we are currently involved with.
Well, what is the railroad inspection program with respect to herbicide?
That's a very good question. I don't think there is any activity. The scope of the inspection team that is taking a look at the railroad for the federal-state changeover is looking and focusing in on facilities only. They're not looking at the right-of-way. And they're also, I asked some of the people that are doing the work if they've encountered pesticide storage facilities or handling or mixing or applying, and that has not occurred. They have not encountered that. They don't know what the procedures or the policies are of the railroad as far as how they go about applying pesticides or herbicides.
The Senator received information from an attorney representing some of the workers of the railroad, and I haven't had a chance to examine that material thoroughly, but I will. But I understand that part of the complaint is work had to do with worker safety, OSHA violations of labor in the railroad. Is that within your jurisdiction?
Not until the changeover becomes effective. We have not received any complaints from employees working at the railroad. Now, we may receive some of those, and that would impact some action. We would have some impact by our action in responding to those complaints.
So, can you summarize again what, if any, relationship the Department of Labor and your office has to the Alaska Railroad?
Right now, the Department of Labor is spending a lot of the money that the legislature appropriated for its information gathering for surveying the facilities to produce a report to the railroad people for correction for health and safety hazards.
Well, that goes to my question. Do you know if or not the work that is ongoing indicates any significant health or safety hazards to Alaska workers, whether they're from herbicide exposure or otherwise?
I am not knowledgeable of that. However, there are people in the Department of Labor that are, and if you can certainly ask them specifically for that information.
But you say that you're not, or they are, you or they are not looking at the right-of-way, you're looking at facilities?
Just facilities, yes. I asked the people that are doing the railroad survey if they wouldn't mind coming here today and giving you some information, and they just asked me to tell you that that's not in their scope as far as looking at the application of herbicides.
Well, is it in their scope to look at hazards in the right of way, you know, such as signalization problems or other hazards to occupational safety?
Not to my knowledge, that isn't part of the survey that is going on now.
Well, who determined the scope of the survey?
I don't know that either.
Senator Fisher?
Assuming the transfer has occurred, and the railroad operates as an arm of the state, what jurisdiction would your department, your office, have over the Alaska Railroad with respect to the issues that are being discussed here today?
We would be looking at the protection of the employees of the railroad that are mixing, applying the pesticides or herbicides.
Is this the kind of jurisdiction you'd have and responsibility for any department of the state?
Yes, it is. We have jurisdiction over all places of employment in the state, whether they're state government or private enterprise.
Okay. You've had jurisdiction over some federal installations, too.
Only because the workers at those workplaces were contract workers. In other words, they were private sector contract workers in contract to military installations or that kind of facility.
We went to, Senator Moss and I went to held hearing at CLEAR, the federal installation near Anderson, about the radiation problem, and your people were involved there because there were some civilian employees.
That's correct.
So the Department, the Alaska State Department of Labor, has not been involved heretofore when the railroad was a federal instrumentality with respect to employee safety and safety hazards at the Alaska Railroad. Is that right?
That's right too.
But after Saturday, that will change, and you would be able then to address the issue of herbicides, not from the standpoint, except incidentally, of health and safety of the Alaska public at large, but focused upon health and safety issues for employees, correct?
That's right. It depends a lot on the direction that we get as far as how much time and effort we can put into that effort. We suspect that we will be spending considerable time looking at railroad facilities and occupational safety and health problems there. The Department of Labor has also recently hired a physician that would enable us to do some medical work on people that have been exposed to herbicides, workers that have been exposed to herbicides, as well as perhaps even collecting blood samples, tissue samples, and have those analyzed. We do have the capability of getting our samples that we collect analyzed, and yes, we do have to go out of state to do it. When you're in the enforcement business, you have to be legal, and the laboratory has to be a certified laboratory within the ramifications of our program, so we have to use that laboratory. There are other, excuse me, I just wanted to say one thing about the analysis. It's very expensive and it's very time consuming, and only occasionally can we use local laboratories. And we only do that for our immediate information purposes, for turnaround time for results. But legally, we cannot resort to uncertified laboratories.
And your office would have had jurisdiction over the Whitehorse Yukon Railway right of way or any herbicide practices there, correct?
I assume we would. I know that we have inspected that facility as far as their train house and their maintenance facility in Skagway.
Well, the workers' rights in those legislation we spoke of actually, as you may know, came from some of the with the substances that we've been talking about be on the list of which the worker would be informed under that statute?
Yes, they are.
So that without anything else being known about them, at least the Alaska workers would be informed that at least they're working in that environment, that they would have, that they would be handling these substances with some information about what they are or what their contents are.
Well, specifically relating to the railroad, that would be one of the recommendations that would be made to them to implement that kind of a program to obtain the material safety data sheets that they need for the materials they're handling and to set up their educational programs for their employees. That's all built in to the system and will happen eventually.
Well, I mean, it's more than a recommendation. Isn't that what the state legislature demanded?
That's right. As a matter of fact, many of the violations that we allege at places of employment are specifically relating to failure to comply with the right to know regulation.
And if you administer the workers' right to know statute, does that imply that you have any opinion as to the toxicity of these particular substances?
Unfortunately, it's such a complicated issue as to what is toxic and what is not toxic, what is safe, what is not safe, to pretty much go with what standards have been developed and which are, that have been researched and set up as limits. So if the material is considered to be hazardous and has a limit of acceptable exposure, that is what I use to make my judgments as to if someone needs to make a change or not, make a correction or do some protective action. So my opinion is if it's hazardous or not, I don't have one. I can't afford to have one, being in my position.
You mean because you haven't material, the staff or laboratories or time to make determinations?
Well, we have to rely heavily upon the research that was done when standards were developed. That research is conducted by national organizations with their high-powered staff. And yes, the state of Alaska does not have the universities, it does not have the laboratories, it does not have the research facilities available. I'm not advocating that they go out and buy them. What I'm saying is that there's a lot, I don't know how much reason or need there is for us to recreate the wheel. If the studies have been done elsewhere and if they're applicable to Alaska, then we don't need to waste the money there. We need to spend the money where it's not being done, where those types of standards development is not applicable to Alaska.
Well, what are the implications of this for the whole health program in Alaska? I mean, we have here a situation, if I can summarize it as I did, where we have some people who are intelligent and even have scientific background and are goodwill to say, this is a non-problem and kind of paranoia running around here, and I handle the materials myself and I feel great. Why should we politicians be concerned about it? And we have other people who say, holy smokes, this is in some laboratory work that is very suggestive of problems, potential birth defects, health hazards may be latent for many, many years. You ought to be darn concerned about it. You know, what I'm hearing you say is that Alaska doesn't have universities, the state doesn't have the staff, and so in the area of toxic and hazardous substances, your office feels hamstrung in terms of what decisions you can make and what you can enforce. I'm wondering what that implies not only here, but generally for your work. Is it a question then whereby Alaska workers will always be a greater hazard than workers in California or New York, where the state government has more sophistication and more personnel and has universities?
I hope not. The statistics have to be looked at as far as occupational injury and illnesses. The gathering of those statistics has to be looked at because of the inadequacies within the data collection system itself. The reporting of injuries and illnesses, if there are people in the state becoming ill and dying or diseased in some way because of an exposure to herbicides, we simply do not have that collected. We are not receiving that information.
Well, but let me take an extreme example. We had the tragedy in India with the poisonous chemical. You can take judicial notice that chemical was lethal in India and led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have to have an Alaska experience with that.
No. You would not, and unfortunately you don't like to make your decisions based upon body counts. You need to have information where people do not have to die before you know that you have a problem. That is the difference, you know, with making a decision about what happened in India and what happened in this state. The possibility of something like that happening here does exist. The Department of Labor is trying to gear up to actually do surveys of spills of dangerous, toxic, and hazardous materials. As a matter of fact, I'm going for training this month to hopefully learn how to do that and set up some kind of procedure that we can follow and do it. And one of the interesting things is that it's going to be very different when you go through decontamination alleys in this state than you do in other states when they're standing out in an open field using water to decontaminate themselves. We can't use that up here. So we're going to have to come up with some other system or some way that is going to involve a lot of research and technical aspects to it.
As an aside, why can't we use that?
Freezing.
Okay. But I also am hearing that they had its own process for research, classification. You have access to the regulatory decisions of your counterparts in Washington State, California, Ohio, and so forth. I mean, there must be some clearinghouse of information on
that's right. We rely heavily upon research of others and try to make it apply to Alaska. I'm not sitting here advocating that we set up our own research team or what have you. That's not what I'm here to say. We do follow the U.S. Department of Labor's mandates on their standard setting. That standard setting is based upon research done all over the world and the country, as well as the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, whatever testing EPA is doing, and what a lot of other national associations and agencies.
I think an earlier witness indicated that every railroad in the country uses a herbicide unit. Is that consistent with what you've been told?
I'm not aware of what pesticides or herbicides are that the railroads use.
Well,
that's really, I'm not really very well prepared to do that, but as far as industrial hygienists, that would be the people primarily with the expertise to look at application of herbicides. There are currently 5 enforcement types and 1 consultant type that cover the entire state. Our working budget for the entire program for all of our staff is somewhere on the order of $2 million. $1 million is matched by $1 million from the U.S. Department of Labor.
Okay.
The transfer of action for the railroad threw a lot of money at the Department of Labor to pick up a couple of people to do the survey. So there are two people that are primarily looking at safety hazards associated with the railroad facilities. The inspectors do not have the health credentials that they should probably be having to make the health, to recognize and evaluate the health hazards.
I just feel like we're getting the runaround. And I'm not trying to be facetious about that at the moment, because I know perhaps your major deal is to take care of the workers. Around this room, we've got several signs that says smoking prohibited by law. That law was created not because of the smoker themselves, because if they're going to die from smoking it, I guess that's their business. But it was for those people that were around the smoker that that law was created for. Now, my point that I'm trying to make and ask the question is, your department is supposed to be responsible for the safety of the workers. How about those people that are around it? Let's take these people that live alongside the railroad, for example. How many times do they have to be exposed to this chemical before your department will say, hey, look, we got a problem here. We have a health and safety problem here. Are you just primarily concerned, though, with strictly people that are employed in the industry that mix and apply these chemicals? We've had testimony here today from a couple of three people that have stated that, hey, we weren't doing it. They were doing it next door. They got sick from it. They had problems from it. Their gardens and things were messed up. We have pains and, that are actually created as a result of it. Now, who do you go to? Now, the applicator, he's covered. He gets a chest ache or he gets sick from eating. He got no problem. OSHA's going to take care of it. State OSHA. But who's going to take care of the next door neighbor or the people that are sitting next door to it? To me, that's a health problem. It's just like this drifting smoke business up here that we spent many hours of testimony on. It's a rather controversial thing. But how do we correct it? We're not doing it that well.
You raise absolutely good questions about where does one's jurisdiction end and where does one's begin. The law that we're operating under says that there has to be an employee-employer relationship. And a lot of people are very, very happy that that's where our jurisdiction does, in fact, end. Where it has to be picked up, then, from that point on, would be the people in charge of public health or the environment. And I see that there's an overlap, a good overlap of that area. The Department of Labor and Occupational Safety and Health Enforcement tries to focus in on the sources of the hazards and the causes of the conditions that would expose the public also, have they happen to be in the vicinity. It's an ancillary protection measure that if we can protect the workers and control the contaminant, that it will not be, it will be controlled in such a way, or protection for it will be made in such a way that it will not spread and affect other people. Unfortunately, when you do things out of doors, which is what is going on out here, it is very difficult to control where the contaminant goes.
My question, though, in a sense, is who's responsible? Who's going to take care of this problem we got out here? We got one agency that takes care of it here. You get outside the boundaries of that railroad or outside that shop or outside of wherever, nobody is concerned with it. This is where I think the majority of these people that we've heard talk today seem to be concerned about it, they're not people that are involved in the industry that's using it. They're people that are exposed. There's smoke that drifts over into their backyard or their home. These are the people I think that we need. But what agency do we have in the state that concerns themselves with it? Public health? OSHA? Labor? Or what have you? Somebody has dropped the ball somewhere if there's nobody that can take care of anything like that. We have a problem. But whose problem is it?
It's a premise. What we're dealing with here, I think, is part of a much more, much huger problem, which is the ability of our political institutions to relate to a technological world where the knowledge of the specialist or the application of that knowledge is running faster than the ability of society to know what's going on and control what's going on. Now, if I'm a worker for the Alaska Railroad, next week I'm going to be working for a state instrumentality or a corporation, and I trust that through the workers' rights no law, the railroad will inform me of the substances that I'm handling or exposed to. I guess the question then becomes, and this is what I'm a little bit unclear about, I know that there is there's an OSHA program, and I know that your office exists. Can I derive, as a worker, any sense of comfort that you're looking after me, that you or some expert working for your department will make a determination as to whether or not my health or my progeny are jeopardized by my exposure to those substances? Right, whether you're right or wrong, are you going to make that judgment on my behalf as my representative using whatever tools you have?
That is done in a place of employment setting. We do that every day. It's also important, one of the reasons why I came here was to let you know as the committee what you cannot expect the Department of Labor to do under the Occupational Safety and Health law. You cannot expect that department with its mandates as given now to protect the general public, the innocent bystander, the person that is walking down the street of Anchorage while the building containing asbestos is being demolished and the people doing the demolition are protected.
Okay, but let me get back to the workers' description. You will, in addition to the workers' right to know, you will make a determination, and again, the determination 100 years from now, we have research as to the life history of all these workers and their families, hopefully, you may be right or you may be wrong, but you'll make your best judgment as to what kind of spraying activities are harmless or harmful to people in my position as a railroad employee worker.
We're going to give that a look. See and give it our best shot in making a decision.
And
that's going to involve an awful lot of work and time and effort, but it can be done and it will be done.
Okay, and if you make that decision, and assume hypothetically, the decision is that the railroad should not use these substances, or that wouldn't be the way your decision would be worded, but that the substances expose the workers to some unacceptable degree of hazard. You would make that decision public, would you?
All of the inspections that we perform and the reports that we make as a result of that are public information.
And there,
if someone is interested and wants to ask us, we certainly can give that information out.
Okay.
We don't normally make press releases about what we found at some job site where there were hazards.
And that is done in the OSHA context. In other words, it could be, and I don't mean to prejudge what your findings are here, but it could be that you would make that finding that the substance would violate the worker's right to a safe environment or workplace. But
yes, we can do that, and putting it in another way, is that we would inform the employer and the employee that the hazards that they're exposed to are dangerous and they're not adequately protected, and that they must take measures to protect from those exposures. Those measures include elimination, substitution, personal protective equipment, and a lot of other types of control, engineering control, or administrative control measures. That is what the employer is told, and the employees.
And your methodology for reaching that point involves review of the literature, federal standards, decision-making by other states, OSHA administrators, plus what? Plus.
Then you would go take a look at the situation, trying to evaluate the exposure that is occurring. You do that by taking blood samples, by conducting air monitoring, collecting samples, getting it analyzed, getting the information together, and then making some judgments as to what levels you've obtained and applying it to a standard, and either then making a mandated control request or making a recommendation that something be done, even though the levels aren't met, they're still an the levels that are enforceable aren't met, there's still exposure, and that something should be done to keep it to an absolute minimum.
In this situation, do you get all this in gear only in the case of a reported accident, fatality, or injury, or would you begin looking at the spraying issue routinely without an incident?
The answer is yes. There are many ways that we enter and select establishments for inspection, as besides the obvious accident, fatality, injury or illness report, complaint, or a referral from another agency. We also can select places of employment for inspection. The where we go is supposedly based upon a worst case, high hazard first approach. But we try to go to the places that have nationally known incidences of serious violations occurring in those facilities. If the railroad is not one of those types of facilities, they would not be selected for or targeted for general inspection. The only other way for that to occur is to mandate it, to somehow give the department some direction that that's what the state of Alaska wants done.
I'd like to follow up on Senator Moss's line of questions before, and that has to do with the broader protection of the public beyond the workers. Do you work with the public health people and the Department of Environmental Conservation when you, for instance, become aware of pesticides or any kind of a hazard that may affect more than just the workers, and they affect the community or the neighbors or whatever? Is there any communication between you and others with dealing with hazardous substances or anything else?
There is communication. There's probably not enough. And what happens generally is that the public health people encounter the problem of exposure to public health and do not have the capability of evaluating it, and they call us to evaluate it on an employee-employer relationship basis. So in one sense of the matter is that Senator Moss is asking who is responsible for it, and there seems to be some indication that there's the people that should be responsible for it are the people that are protecting the environment, such as the Department of Environmental Conservation or the Public Health Department or whoever. But they frankly do not have the technical equipment or the funding or the people or all of that, and they rely upon our little department to come up with our expensive equipment and do the monitoring and measuring. And we have done that.
You have done it for purposes beyond just the workers who are the basic clients that you're concerned about.
That has happened, yes.
Okay, thank you. The other point I just want to sort of reiterate and get it completely clear, because we've heard from the Alaska Railroad Board of Directors and some other people, editorials, that state government stay off the back of the railroad, let the railroad operate independently and so on. So far as your jurisdiction is concerned, if the railroad were a private business, you would still have the same responsibility and same jurisdiction when it comes to worker safety as you would if they are environmentally state government.
That's correct. And I see or suspect that the railroad, whoever is running it, is going to need a lot of help from us. And we're certainly willing to provide that for them. There is a way within, there's two ways that people that are running businesses can get help for occupational safety and health. They can ask for it through a consultant, voluntary type of a way where we will send consultants out to evaluate their problems, and they do not run the risk of being cited or fined. The other way is for us to knock on their door unannounced and conduct an inspection, and they do run the risk of being cited and fined. So the facility or the program that's available to the railroad to get assistance without having to put their life on the line is to ask to use our voluntary compliance services. They're free to all of the places of employment in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I noticed that we do have Bill Emmer on the room from ACDC. Do you want to say anything?
No, not really, but Bill, we're going to hear it. You know, that's that program.
All right.
Bill? Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me more or less cut in at this time. I would like to add a clarification to the previous testimony. OSHA, or the State Department of Labor, is responsible for workers. The safety of the workers involving pesticide use, pesticide application, pesticide long-term effects. The Department of Environmental Conservation, to answer Senator Morse's question, is responsible for everybody else, including the general aspects of the environment. In addition, the Department of Environmental Conservation's pesticide section has had a responsibility since past 8 years in that under a contract with the federal government, we are responsible for the federal pesticide laws, which is known as the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, known affectionately as FIFRA. To use the Alaska Railroad as a specific example, I have worked with the Alaska Railroad on their pesticide use and safety program for the past 6 years. In that connection and in my federal responsibilities, I have worked with the workers. So the workers have not been uncovered by a state official. In addition to the work we've done with the railroad, I've dealt with the various environmental groups, many of whom are here today. I think they will confirm that they have not been ignored by our department. I might say that like most government agencies, we're not happy with the staff that the pesticide program has. At the present time, it has one person. I would like to say this in connection with one of the main problems. We have done some research. This research has been published in University Bulletin. It is in connection with the long-term effects of the phenoxy herbicides on the environment. You've heard a great deal about acute toxicity, and you've heard a great deal about chronic toxicity. Taking federal recommendations, you can give me a pesticide, and I can give you the safety relative to its acute toxicity. If you or Ovi Weeks or Paul Bratton was to ask me, what is the chronic toxicity? What is the result of that being sprayed along my right-of-way for 20 years? I cannot answer that very well with anybody's data. We have attempted to get a little cold weather data in this matter. I might add, too, that it was funded almost entirely by the railroad. The expense, I would estimate, has come close to $250,000 over the past 6 years. Aside from my salary and some of my samples, the work was almost entirely funded by the Engineering Department of the Alaska Railroad. It gives us one of the very few databases that we have on toxicity in cold climates. this has been mentioned. It's a very complicated subject. But if you've tried to light a Zippo lighter in cold weather, you know darn well it doesn't work as well as it would in Mississippi. The same thing happens to our pesticides. They don't disappear as fast. They don't work as well. The dosage that's recommended for Kansas, Mississippi, California, where most of the research is done, is not totally applicable up here. It would be nice if we had a big, extensive system to do this. We do not. There is in the university system one investigator at a PhD level who is working on herbicides. There's myself, and the railroad studies have been finished for the present. And that's about it in this state. I could probably count on the fingers of my two hands the amount of publications that I consider good, solid work that have been done on the degradation of pesticides in northern latitudes. There's not much to go on. As a result, as the gentleman from OSHA said, and I do it too, we make a lot of decisions based upon lower 48 data. Most of the time it works. Sometimes it's been called into question. If it is called into question, it takes a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of bodies to answer the question. We did some work. It was a very small work. It's like most research, it indicated that we had something else to do after we finished that.
That's very interesting, and follows under Martha's question about climate and seemingly consistent with what we know about Arctic, subarctic climates and their effect on degrading materials. But that would lead me to infer that we should be very cautious about these studies, as you say, in Kansas, Missouri, whatever. We should err on the side of caution because of the climatic conditions.
I think I do, Senator. I get about 500 phone calls a year from people who say, what do I do with this pesticide? Or what pesticide should I get? Or do I need a pesticide? I say literally half of them, I tell them, no pesticide anymore. Stay away from it. I'll give them other tricks.
Well, has the railroad ever asked your office for alternatives to the pesticides they use? Or for, how do you get involved in this, if at all, in the decision making about what herbicides to select and where, how they should be used?
In the beginning, when I came on the job about 10 years ago, the 2,4-5-T, which has been mentioned in previous testimony, was used commonly in the state. It was used by the highway department and by the railroad, I think. In that case, when I came on the job, I said, this is no good. This one is a bummer. It will make more trouble than it's worth. And I spent the first couple of years on the job getting voluntary compliance, and I got it. That when 2,4-5-T was banned almost totally by the federal government, we were using very little. Only some home gardeners had some. So that's the way I usually work, sir.
But does the railroad use 2,4-5-T?
At the present time, it's used 2,4-D, a related compound.
And a difference from your standpoint?
The D compound is far safer than the T compound.
And is 2,4-5-T used anywhere in Alaska anymore?
No, sir.
One quick question. Have you had any dealings with railroads in Canada? For example, the one that goes through Fort Nelson on further north, have you had any dealings with them about what they use to clear their right-of-ways and the problems they have had?
No, Senator, I have not had direct dealings. I've obtained some of the railroad data through Alaska Survival, particularly the Boston and Maine has been very cooperative, by the way.
Thank you very much for coming forward. Let me ask if we have witnesses to participate in the MATSU. The MATSU teleconference. Are there witnesses to be heard?
Observers do not wish to participate in this time, sir.
Are there any witnesses that you know wish to do?
Nothing, just the
okay. Is Mary Corden? Are there other witnesses in anger who wish to do? Yes, this one. That's lady behind.
Senators, I'm Diane Sutherland, and I represent...
Diane, you have to press the bar or put the button in lock.
Okay. I'm Diane Sutherland, and I represent the Environmental Protection Agency. I work in the Alaska Operations Office. And I'm here today primarily to provide some information on EPA's roles and responsibilities with regard to pesticides in Alaska. The position that I'm filling is a brand new position to Alaska. It was allocated from EPA in Washington, D.C. to Anchorage just this year. And it's going to provide a lot of different functions to the state on an annual basis. There's a first order of business and a second order of business, and I'll get into those in a minute. But first I wanted to provide just a little background on what EPA does with regard to pesticides. As Dr. Burgoyne pointed out, the federal involvement in pesticides stems from the enactment of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFRA. And under that act, EPA was mandated to promulgate regulations to protect the nation's environment from unsafe uses or abuses of pesticides. The act further stipulated that EPA could enter into cooperative agreements with state agencies, and therefore allow the state to have the primary responsibility for implementing the program. And that's exactly what we've done in Alaska. EPA has delegated the responsibility for implementing FIFRA to the Department of Environmental Conservation, and that was done in 1977. So up to this point, EPA's role with regard to pesticides has been primarily to provide funds to the state DEC, and those funds have usually been found in the amount of $10,000 to $15,000 annually and have been used solely for the purpose of certifying and training operators. There are also other funds that are available, and those funds, the $10,000 to $15,000 annually, are matched by the state. They're matching grant funds. The state also has other funds available to them, usually in the range of $45,000 to $60,000 annually for enforcement purposes. But so far, the state has opted not to accept those grant monies.
Say that again. What money does the state decide not to accept?
It's $45,000 to $60,000 available annually for enforcement purposes under FIFRA.
Is there a match?
I believe they're matching, yes. I'm not positive of that, though. I'm sorry, I've just recently taken on this position, and I don't know all the intricacies yet. The first order of business for the position that I have assumed is to develop a profile or an inventory of pesticide uses in the state of Alaska. At this point, it's unknown what quantity of pesticides are used in the state, where they're used, et cetera, whether they create a problem. And the first order of business, and it will take about a year, is to develop this profile, which, when completed, will provide a fairly comprehensive inventory of pesticide uses in the state. It will include the quantities used, the concentrations, the acreage that's covered, where they're being used at, who's using them, is it commercial applicators, is it private citizens, what are the problems with those uses, and what the state needs are, what are the needs for pesticides. And when I'm talking about pesticides, I'm talking about a very broad scope. I'm talking about pesticides used in seafood processing, in the oil and gas industry, in agriculture, in vegetation control right-of-way, and janitorial services, more than just the herbicide issues that were originally looked at today. Beyond that, the profile will include information on the agreements that have been made between EPA and other state agencies, or different agency roles with regards to pesticides. It will summarize that information. So hopefully it will be a very all-encompassing document It can be used as a tool by regulators and private citizens to determine what the real potentials for problems are and in what industries they center. Beyond that, EPA will be providing a little bit more support to the state in general, pesticide issues and implementation of FIFRA. As Dr. Burgoyne said, the staff with the state so far has been one, and obviously there may be a necessity to have more people than that in the program.
Do you know what happens when people get smoke on and the people smoke, or the guys get pesticides or herbicides going next door? Is that, if I got that problem, does that come to you?
Well, EPA has delegated that program to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. So no, if you have that problem, you go to State DEC. But if DEC has questions or needs assistance, or if for some reason you didn't get adequate response, then you could come to me.
In other words, you've got, without being facetious, somebody else is passing it on to somebody else. This is the problem that I see right now. I don't think that the average citizen is going to be able to, if he's got a problem, and that's the broad picture, who the devil do we go to? Now we say we go to DEC now. I hope that somebody at DEC.
That was Dr. Bill Burgoyne who just spoke. Was from the Department of Environment.
I didn't hear him say he's going to take care of the next door neighbor, though.